This is Dropout Nation. I'm Rashawn Biddle. Today, on the Dropout Nation podcast, beyond budget cuts, what states must do to make education spending more efficient for student achievement. Well, if you are a governor of a state these days, you face a major challenge. And the same is true for legislators as well. You have to make up $140 billion in budget shortfalls in 2011 budgets, and then altogether $260 billion over the next two fiscal years, according to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Governors and state legislators will not be able to count on the natural growth in tax dollars. After all, we are now still in an economic downturn, even though we're supposed to be in a recovery. And while there have been some governors, notably Pat Quinn in Illinois, who have been able to levy tax increases, the reality for most states is that tax increases are out of the question. After all, especially if you are any of the 29 Republican governors, your whole platform is largely based on opposing any sort of tax increases. This means taking the knife and making cuts. And this is especially true when it comes to education spending. Over the past few years, education spending has increased every year for most of the past decade. In fact, between 2006 and 2007 and 2007-2008, those fiscal years alone, education spending increased by $31 billion. Think of it that way. $31 billion for an education system that spends more than nearly $600 billion a year. States account for the plurality of all education spending, providing 48% of all dollars that go to schools. In fact, education is one of the top budget items for states, usually neck and neck with Medicaid and welfare spending. And state sources are particularly involved in sustaining large urban school districts, many of which have been starved for funding largely due to bad urban land policies, including tax abatements, that have essentially robbed school districts of funds. We know that in Newark, for example, state funding provides for 83% of all school dollars. In Philadelphia, it's 53%. And altogether, states are really, ultimately, they have to look at education spending. And not only do they have to look at education spending because it's such a huge portion of the budget, and because they are picking up so much of the tab, the other aspect of it ultimately comes down to this. One, it is the state's responsibility. After all, education systems are a priority of the state. They, in fact, in many cases, are creations of state constitutions. Second part is the increasing knowledge that when it comes to all aspects of education, there really is no correlation between school spending in the main and student achievement. This past week, the Center for American Progress released a report studying spending patterns in 9,000 school districts throughout the country. 9,000, by the way, out of 13,000, in fact, 14,000 school districts throughout the United States. So that's the vast majority of school districts. This report showed that in many cases, high-spending districts are also inefficient, gaining the same levels of achievement as those districts that are spending at lesser levels. In fact, you could say that in some cases you have two school districts who are achieving low levels or even just getting by, but one district is spending as much as $8 million more than the other to get the same results. In Florida, for example, just 17% of the top third schools in terms of school spending were also in the top third in student achievement. And this is mitigated for such things, this number, by the way, is mitigated for such things as poverty, mitigated for such things as dealing with the fact that some school districts have lots of Title I needs that they deal with. it's important for states to really look at school spending, but it is equally important for states to consider really what spending is. It's not just a matter of simply cutting budgets. The reality is that the problem in education spending has less to do with the amount of money spent or just what is spent on, but how it's spent, ultimately. Getting to the heart of school spending is critical to making smart decisions about education spending overall. Some of this, of course, relates to the districts. After all, we've known, for example, that in urban districts, they have more administrators and staffers than teachers, with a ratio of administration of staff to teachers that are 2-to-1. But administrative costs are a problem throughout all kinds of districts. And it goes beyond the urban center. As the Center for American Progress pointed out, inefficient districts spend on average an extra 3% of their budgets on administrative overhead. That's 3% ultimately more than what their more efficient counterparts do. Meanwhile, the services that schools are spending are also often inefficient. As Michael Casserly of the Council for Great City Schools has pointed out, just 69% of school buses are kept in operation. The fact that the nation spends $53 billion in 2008 on school construction, nearly a tenth of all public education spending, means that in many communities, billions are spent on football stadiums, sports complexes, and other aspects instead of on classroom activity. But forcing districts to just cut into administrative overhead, cutting school construction and other bloat, that's just the beginning. The real costs come not from those areas, but ultimately from obsolete education practices, antiquated structures of educational operations and governance, and state laws that protect low-quality instruction and curriculum. Ultimately, it is what traditional public education has been doing for more than a century that is the costliest part, and the part that states must focus on. It starts with how schools are funded in the first place. The program and formula-based approaches to funding, which basically ties up money in various programs, they do nothing more than actually tie the hands of school districts and of school principals. This, along with the fact that state laws and collective bargaining agreements basically leave personnel decisions in the hands of teachers' unions and school districts, essentially means that lots of money are being tied up at the central office of school districts, and oftentimes tied up without any consideration of what children really need for their academic instruction. So principals, who control almost none of their budgets or any of the personnel decisions, they're unable to make school decisions that can enhance student achievement. In California, for example, $41 million was spent on recruiting physical ed teachers in order to combat childhood obesity. But guess what? Physical ed teachers are not a shortage position. In fact, there's plenty of them. And the funds weren't even well targeted. They didn't go to schools with high percentages of obese students. Instead, they went to all over the place, which meant that districts that didn't necessarily need additional phys ed teachers or any sort of deal with any sort of aspects of obesity ended up getting money, while those high-need districts may have not gotten enough to make any sort of impact. Then there are state laws and collective bargaining agreements, which trap money in educational practices that not only are costing billions, they're also fueling our nation's educational crisis. Tenure, for example, which basically does life, essentially creates life, near lifetime employment, essentially ends up keeping low-quality teachers in schools for years as they earn pensions, as they earn salary increases, without consideration for performance, which means that laggard teachers are staying in jobs, meanwhile high-quality teachers are also in the jobs. These are quality-blind rules. The same with degree and seniority-based pay scales, which ignore ability to improve student achievement and reward teachers based on their tenure and the number of degrees they get. We know that $8 billion a year is spent on degree-based pay increases, rewarding teachers for getting master's degrees, even though there is clear evidence that there is no correlation between graduate degree attainment and student achievement. And then we have class size reduction laws, which have helped fuel a decade-long boom in teacher hiring and increases in school spending, even though the evidence shows that class size reductions only work for poor students, and because of the way state laws are put together, they don't really have any effect for any students, for either the poor or the middle class. What we've seen in turn is this, along with negotiations and pay increases, what we've seen now is huge expenses in spending on teaching, on teachers and teacher instruction, and ultimately on benefits and salaries. We now know that the average state now spends 34 cents on benefits for every dollar teacher salary, versus 28 cents back in 2003-2004. Essentially, what we have is a lot of money being tied up in practices that don't really work. Meanwhile, we have other aspects, even more structural issues. The fact that that states have not taken up full funding of education, allowing for local property dollars to still account for significant percentages of overall school funding, has done little more than frustrate efforts to improve education, to enact school choice, to expand charter schools, to expand a range of options for students. Essentially, what ends up happening is that the districts can, on one hand, continue to receive state funding, but at the same time ignore efforts to improve choice, to make improvements in teacher quality, because they are getting local dollars, and therefore they don't have to necessarily pay attention. This sort of situation, as I sort of call it, suspended animation in school governance, really means essentially that we still haven't dealt fully with what education is going to look like and should look like. Meanwhile, in most states, education governance remains Byzantine, a legacy of the efforts of progressive reformers to guard against centralized power and isolate education from politics. But the structures have led to competing bureaucracies that battle to control their respective budgets, the muddying of policymaking and turf battles that stall reforms and in turn tie up money. In many states, there is no reason why a teacher licensing board shouldn't be part of a state education department. In fact, one would dare say because education departments are critical and teacher licensing are critical aspects of state policy, they should be under one umbrella. Meanwhile, one aspect that we cannot go into this podcast is dealing with the more than $600 billion in teacher pension deficits and unfunded retired teacher liabilities. That reality faces states in the long term. They must figure out ways to deal with that. And that is part, and that those problems are legacies of poor state policymaking. States must confront the reality that they are responsible for school finance, and they must fully restructure how school funding is delivered and spent throughout American public education. One step starts with making school finance fully a state priority. Ultimately, it really should be funded by the state instead of a combination of state dollars and local education and local tax, property tax dollars. It really should be all state funding. Through this, not only can states do a better job of streamlining regulations and controlling how money is spent, it can also even go further by essentially voucherizing school dollars, and so that the school funding actually follows children. States must take on that role. States must also reform their governance structures. putting governors in full control of school oversight, instead of having a collection of state boards of education, superintendents, teacher licensing agencies, and other organizations. Simplifying the structure would be a key step in both saving money, streamlining education regulation, and ultimately being able to pinpoint problems within American public education. States must also fully abandon program and formula-based approaches to school funding. Instead, states should essentially, voucherize their funding and have funds following the child in a weighted student funding formula. Through this method, not only do you allow school, do you essentially create the possibility of school reform, you also may create the possibility of being able to better make money better used and more efficiently spent. And in the process, moving school budget decisions down to principals and to headmasters and to the school itself. And it is also time to take on the way we recruit, train, and compensate teachers. We've begun making these moves thanks to Race to the Top and the No Child Left Behind Act by requiring the use of student test data to evaluate teacher performance. We now must take the next steps. This includes embracing new forms of compensation in order to reward high-quality teaching. States must also begin evaluating the efficiency of school spending. At this moment, just two states, Texas and Florida, already do so. Most states can do so if they invest the money in school data systems, and in fact just do a better job of looking at the various funding streams that already exist, but they don't, and they need to. And finally, states must take strong steps towards righting their ships in terms of long-term pension and retirement obligations. Let's be very clear. Most states are essentially insolvent if you look at all of their long-term pension and retiree obligations. One step starts with increasing teacher contributions to pension and retirements. Another is to abandon defined benefit pensions and go to defined contribution programs. Ultimately, states must take the effort to go and reform their systems of school finance. Governors must make this move, so must state legislators, and ultimately, it's best for everyone, including our kids. Listen to the Dropout Nation podcast every Sunday night. Also, read Dropout Nation for your news and commentary on the reform of American public education. Read my columns in the American Spectator and National Review. And also, in the next coming weeks, look for some special Dropout Nation packages as well. This is Dropout Nation. I'm Rashawn Biddle. Good night.